You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair, Part B. Today's broadcast is in honor of my mother, who taught me that reading is pure joy. Here's the continuation of The Lost Cause by Ta-Nehisi Coates, with illustrations by Yannick Lowry. Literature is anguish. Even small children know this. I was no older than 5, crying in the back seat of my parents' orange Volkswagen while they argued up front. When they turned to comfort me, they were shocked to learn that I was crying not about their argument, but about the grasshopper who starved in winter while the ant feasted. The wolf devours Grandma. The gingham dog and the calico cat devour each other. I was not born into a religious home, but I knew that my peers had been raised on stories of God casting Adam and Eve from paradise for biting an apple, that he had destroyed all life save that contained in the ark on a whim, that he had condemned me and every other non-believer to eternal suffering. I suspect these believers would say that the anguish, this discomfort radiating out of their own gospel, is not incidental, but is at the heart of its transformative power. For my part, the anguish of the story of the grasshopper and the ant was in the moral of the story, that laziness and foolishness made one worthy of starvation. This kind of retribution left me empty, and even then I felt I wanted no part of a world that called starvation just. That was my personal revelation, and one that apparently ran contrary to the story's intended message. But in my anguish, in my disagreement with the core of the text, I found my truth, and that, I suspect, is the real problem. Whatever the attempt to ape the language of college students, it is neither anguish nor discomfort that these people were trying to prohibit. It was enlightenment. I tracked down Mary's number. We spoke for about a half an hour. She talked about the whole ordeal, the paranoia incited by anonymous complaints, the school board meetings where she was pilloried, the threats to her job. She spoke of the conservative tilt of the area where she taught, Chapin, South Carolina, a lakeside town to the northwest of the state capital of Columbia. She spoke of her own enlightenment, of going off to college and reading post-colonial literature until she felt the puzzle pieces of the world locking into place. She talked of George Floyd's murder and how she'd formed a book group with her department in that watershed summer. That was how she found Between the World and Me. We were the same age. We both had children who drove us crazy. We both practiced yoga for sanity, and she needed it now more than ever. All this she said in an accent that told me that she was not just from some place, but of that someplace. I have an accent just like that, remarkable as a facial scar. And there was something else just as remarkable. Mary didn't teach civics or current events. She taught writing, advanced placement language and composition, to be precise. For the exam, students would have to write an argumentative essay themselves, and to help them learn how, she'd called upon Between the World and Me, my loud and boisterous second son. Perhaps I am straining the metaphor, but I really did feel like one of my children had gone and gotten someone else into trouble. "What will you do next year?" I asked Mary toward the end of our phone call. "I'm going to finish the lesson I started," she said. I'm going to teach between the world and me. I sat on the phone, silent, for 8 seconds. Writing is all process to me, not finished work. It begins in the kind of anguish South Carolina sought to forbid, sometimes originating in something I've read, but more often in the world itself, in peoples and systems whose declared aims run contrary to their actions. And through reading, through reporting, I begin to comprehend a truth. That moment of comprehension is ecstatic. Writing and rewriting is the attempt to communicate not just a truth, but the ecstasy of a truth. It is not enough for me to convince the reader of my argument. I want them to feel that same private joy that I feel. When I go out in the world, it's gratifying to hear that people have shared part of that joy. But Mary didn't just enjoy reading the book. The book had brought her into the fight. I finally broke the silence. I told Mary that I had been thinking of coming down there, but I feared making a tense situation worse. Still, she urged me to come. There was a school board meeting in a week, which she and some of her supporters would attend. I agreed to join them. By the next week, I was with Mary, eating salad and drinking iced green tea at a restaurant near Chapin. She was the portrait of a familiar Southern archetype. Blonde, kind, outgoing, homegrown, daughter of the local football coach and a kindergarten teacher. Her claim to Chapin was strong, stronger even than some of the parents who despised her. The town had been an influx. The town had seen an influx of families looking to live somewhere conservative and traditional. Mary wasn't that. Next illustration, a statue of Confederate cavalry leader and enslaver Wade Hampton on the grounds of the South Carolina State House. She was fighting for her job in the very school where she had earned her own high school diploma. How much this fact would help was unclear. Chapin High School was overseen by Lexington Richland School District 5. The district has long leaned conservative. During the Trump years, it toppled. School board meetings had become an open mic for reactionaries, conspiracy theorists, and attention seekers. The visible radicalization began with the district's response to COVID. Local residents began queuing up at meetings to denounce quarantining as tyranny. I've watched videos of these events, and they feel formless, a rage in search of a cause. The rage went from masking and vaccination to DEI and pronouns. Something called emotional learning would catch an occasional stray, but mostly the great enemy of Chapin was critical race theory. It was said that District 5 had become a staging ground for educational warfare on CRT, a doctrine that was held responsible for anxiety, depression, and self-hatred that raised suicide rates and that made students ashamed to be white. I was told that there was an occasional air of menace at the meetings, as when one speaker warned the board, "We are watching," or another claimed that the country was under the sway of practitioners of pagan ways and exponents of child sacrifice and the drinking of blood. And it was quite normal for such sentiments to be applauded by spectators. That District 5 school board meetings had become contentious was reflected in the security that greeted me at the door. I had to empty my pockets, permit my bag to be searched, and passed through a metal detector. On the other side, I saw two beefy men dressed in army green with visible bulletproof vest. This struck me as a bad omen, but the guards greeted me politely, and when Mary and I turned the corner into the hallway leading to the meeting room, we were met by a woman named Brandy, a middle school science teacher. She stood in front of a table, handing out flyers against censorship, and when she saw us, she smiled warmly. Inside the meeting room, people milled around and chatted. There were tables at the front of the room, assembled in a U-shape, with microphones and nameplates for the various officers of the district. We walked over to the side of the room opposite from the tables, where Mary's mother, Catherine, waited for us. I shook her hand, and her eyes grew big, and she smiled. She pointed us to our seats, which she'd reserved, and in mine, I found a copy of Between the World and Me. "Would you sign, please?" Catherine asked, still smiling. I signed, sat down, and scanned the crowd. What I noticed was that half the people in the room were wearing blue T-shirts. Mary explained that blue was the school color, and Brandy had organized a group of sympathizers on Facebook, asking them to wear blue to show their support for Mary. An older woman named Bobby sat next to me, and we struck up a conversation. She did not know Mary and did not wear a blue T-shirt, but she explained that after George Floyd's death, her church had created a reading group around race. She'd become a huge Colson Whitehead fan. The head of that group read about Mary and urged all the members to come out and show support. This was the second time I'd heard of a reading group in this town as the epicenter of political disruption. From bell hooks on, books by black authors helped Mary understand why things are so effed up. And it was these books that had brought Bobby out to support Mary. I understand the impulse to dismiss the import of the summer of 2020, to dismiss the national conversations, the raft of TV specials and documentaries, even the protests themselves. Some of us see the lack of policy change and wonder if the movement itself was futile. But policy change is an endpoint, not an origin. The cradle of material change is in our imagination and ideas. And whereas white supremacy, like any other status quo, can default to the cliched claims and excuses for the world as it is, bad cops are rotten apples, America is guardian of the free world, we have the burden of crafting new language and stories that allow people to imagine that new policies are possible. And now, even here in Chapin, some people, not most, it is hardly ever most, had, through the work of black writers, begun that work of imagining. The board chair gaveled the meeting to order at 7 p.m. sharp. She noted the full house and seemed to be girding herself for what was coming. The board called for a moment of silence for a great tragedy, the specifics of which the chair did not explain. There was a prayer and the Pledge of Allegiance and a report from the superintendent on academic freedom. From that point, allusions to Mary's case crept into the board's business until about an hour in, when the undercard, having been completed, the main event commenced. The board was giving the community its opportunity to speak. As the first woman approached the microphone, I scanned the room, trying to ascertain the breadth of Mary's support. Only a few weeks earlier, parents were queued up at this same meeting to demand her firing. Now, when I looked out, I saw that the blue T-shirts were populous enough to indicate that her backers were deep. And then the comments began. It was a blowout. Parent after parent lined up to support Mary, most of them met by whooping cheers. A 14-year-old girl stood up and quoted from Between the World and Me, noting that in all her time in school, she had never been assigned a book by a black author. Mary cried silently and whispered to me a running commentary about each speaker, their family, their occupation, whether they had kids in the district. No one, not a single speaker, stood up to support the book's banning. I was initially surprised by this. but later I understood. School board meetings and local politics are small affairs, easily dominated by an organized faction, and that night, the faction was Mary's. Sometimes I will be at a reception or an event, or even out on the street, and a brother will approach me to thank me for my work, and his build, how he moves, his language, his haircut, will inform me that he has just finished a bid. I see these brothers, and I remember my time teaching in a prison. I see these brothers, and I see that shadow version of myself that my parents and teachers warned would take shape if the notes in lipstick red continued, if my conduct did not improve. The line between me and them, between me and the shadow, feels thin. I don't think I have an intended reader. Audience is not something I think about directly, but if I did, it would be those brothers, or rather that younger version of them, trying to navigate the line. There was not a single person like that in the audience at that hearing, which was about what I expected, and I'd spoken to enough audiences to understand that if you're lucky, your writing moves beyond its imagined recipients. But I wasn't speaking here. I wasn't even the subject. What I seemed to be witnessing was less about a book as it was about something more localized, a kind of referendum on the school district's identity. Mary taught an advanced placement class, which is to say her audience was not kids meandering off to college, as I had, but students aiming for college credits and a head start in that world. There was a sense in the room that avoiding divisive concepts was not just wrong on moral grounds, but that it represented a lowering of standards. That to ban a book was to erect a kind of South Carolina exception for advanced placement, one that validated the worst caricatures of Southern whiteness, often bandied by the kind of Northerner who thinks we should have just let them secede. The room was embarrassed. I remember one man, Josh Gray, a professor at the University of South Carolina, standing up, his hair pulled back in a ponytail, and bringing this self-inflicted humiliation into view in a way that would never have occurred to me. I can tell you, as a redneck who's worked all over the world and met people from all over the world, he said, don't make the perception that the students have to compete against worse by actions like this that do not reflect well on our community. This may seem self-interested, a stance taken more to avoid a stigma than to break an arrangement of power. It's a legitimate question, especially in the age of social media and loud virtue signaling that followed 2020. But virtues should be signaled, and the signalers should act to make their virtues manifest. It is the absence of the latter, not the presence of the former, that is the problem. And I doubt that anyone ever parts with power in the name of charity. In this case, self-interest meant that here in the heart of Jim Crow and redemption, ideas to the contrary could not be driven from the public square. And that is progress. It just isn't inevitable that such progress continues. The following afternoon, I met Mary for barbecue. I was actually giddy from the night before. I had expected to come into a den of hectoring fanatics, and instead, I'd found that there were allies fighting back. Allies! When I started writing, it felt essential to think of white people as readers as little as possible, to reduce them, in my mind, to resist the temptation to translate. I think that was correct. What has been surprising, pleasantly so, is that there really is no translation needed, that going deeper actually reveals the human. Get to the universal through the specific, as the rule goes. Still, even as I have come to understand this, it feels abstract to me. What I wanted was to be Mary for a moment, to understand how she came to believe that it was worth risking her job, over a book. Mary's grandfather was a social worker and World War II vet who was blinded disarming mines. He came home a ferocious advocate for the disabled, but black disabled veterans particularly. Although Mary knew her grandfather, he didn't talk about his history as an activist. She found out from a book after his death. Her parents were more liberal than the norm, the type who in a red voting district still put out a Biden 2020 lawn sign. But what she mostly had growing up was an ill-defined sense that the world, as it was conventionally explained, didn't make sense. She'd been bred to be a Southern lady, but it didn't really take. She had to be bribed into etiquette class with Bojangles. In church, Mary did not obsess over being saved so much as she wondered why there were no women in the pulpit. And then, in college, books righted the frame. She read Bell Hooks's Talking Back, Thinking Feminist, Thinking Black. When she finished, she called her mother and said, "This is why things are so effed up." It was exactly the experience that the purveyors of 13950, the book banners, and those targeting CRT were seeking to prevent. We finished eating and took a drive over to the state capitol. South Carolina was the first state to secede, and also the state where both Reconstruction and Redemption reached their most spectacular ends. All through that period, South Carolina had been a majority black state, and at the height of Reconstruction, before its undoing and redemption, the state was home to an emancipated working class and a multiracial democracy. It's quite the story, but it's not the one that the State House tells. There is a beautiful sculpture there, wrought by the astronaut-turned-artist Ed Dwight. But most of the sprawling 22 acres of the State House proper are a shrine to white supremacy. A collection of giant statues sits on raised platforms, so that men like Strom Thurmond, who pinned his entire political career on segregation, loom like gods. Wade Hampton, who enslaved generations and then fought in a bloody war to uphold that system, is there. So is Ben Tillman, who once boasted of lynching from the Senate floor. Tillman knew of what he spoke. In 1876, Tillman pitched in to massacre black people in Hamburg, and in 1895, he'd rallied white South Carolinians to write black people out of the state's constitution. The movement to erase black people from politics swept through the South and won the day in legislatures, state houses, and courts. But if you just looked at the obvious organs of the government, you'd miss the breadth of the attack. We have lived under a class of people who ruled American culture with a flaming cross for so long that we have sometimes failed to recognize the political power of culture. But they have not, and so the redeemers of this age look out and see their kingdom besieged by trans Barbies, Muslim mutants, daughters dating daughters, sons trick-or-treating as African kings. The fear instilled by this rising culture is not for what it does today, but what it augurs for tomorrow, a different world in which the boundaries of humanity are not so easily drawn and enforced. In this context, the mom for liberty shrieking, "Think of the children," must be taken seriously. What she is saying is that her right to the America she knows, her right to the biggest and greenest of lawns, to the most hulking and sturdiest SUVs, to an arsenal of infinite AR-15s, rest on a hierarchy, on an order, helpfully explained and sanctified by her country's ideas, art, and methods of education. That is the heart of it. It is not a mistake that Mary teaches writing at its most advanced level, and has found herself a target. Much of the current hoopla about book bans and censorship gets it wrong. This is not personal. It is political. It is not about me or any other writer. It is about all of us, writers and readers, comrades, and the work we do together, to think, to question, to imagine. I can't say I always knew it, but in my time teaching, it soon became clear that becoming a good writer would not be enough. We needed more writers, and I had a responsibility to help them as a reader to be an active audience for the stories they wanted to tell, or as a teacher so that they could learn to tell them better, to reach deeper into their own truth in the same way that brought me euphoria, and reach into the hearts of readers and set them on fire, as Mary had been set on fire since college, by words on a page. As we walked the grounds of the State House, I thought about what it meant for a young student to visit these same grounds. I thought about what it must mean to walk amongst these Klansmen, enslavers and segregationists, raised up on their platforms to the status of titans. I thought about what it means to go back to the schools, where work rooted in these truths is slowly being pushed out, to the libraries that are being bleached of discomforting stories. And I thought how it all works not simply to misinform, but to miseducate, not just to assure the right answers are memorized, but that the wrong questions are never asked. The statues and pageantry can fool you. They look like symbols of wars long settled and on behalf of men long dead. But their redemption is not about honoring a past. It's about killing a future. in plain sight. Amateur art sleuth Clifford Scharer III has helped find lost works by Dürer, Rembrandt, and Rubens. Now he's embarked on his greatest discovery yet, cracking a 43-year-old cold case by Adam Leith Gallner, opening photograph by Diana Markosian. 21st Century Sherlock, self-taught art detective Clifford Scharer III, who divides his time between London, Boston, Vermont, and Mashpee, Massachusetts, at his modernist home in Provincetown, Massachusetts. On the evening of April 7, 2021, the amateur art detective Clifford Scharer III was seated on a couch in his glass house. In silence, he opened a manila envelope that had been sent to him by a respected Massachusetts attorney. The packet contained evidence related to an unsolved crime. Scharer's mid-century modern home, designed in 1956 by Bauhaus founder Walter Gropius, sits atop a majestic dune at the western edge of Provincetown. Its floor-to-ceiling windows offer 270-degree views of the seascape below. After dark, with the lights on, the glass house glows like a television screen. Since Scharer and his spouse, Chris, never close the front blinds, passers-by can actually see into the home, as if watching a show about a sleuth who tracks down missing artworks. Had you peered through the panes on that spring night, you might have spied Scharer in front of the fireplace, on his Danish modern sofa, leafing through photocopied pages, seeking clues, as he often does. "Your interesting package has now found its way to my hand," he would write the lawyer who had mailed the envelope. In fact, he had told that attorney some weeks earlier, "You know what I do all day long? I look for paintings." Scharer already had a reputation for finding lost masterpieces worth millions, but this dossier contained the makings of his biggest case yet. The documents related to a 1978 home invasion in Worcester, Massachusetts, during which 9 highly valuable paintings were taken, including works by several old masters. The stolen art, Scharer calculated, would now be worth roughly $34 million. Like the 1990 hit at Boston's Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum, in which 13 pieces, estimated at $500 million, had been swiped, the Worcester mystery ranked among America's most confounding art heist. For decades, there had been no cracks in the case. But then again, Clifford Scharer III had never looked into it. Scharer has quite a track record. In 2019, he uncovered an original Albrecht Dürer, today valued at 8 figures. Remarkably, it had wound up in a yard sale for $30. Vienna's Der Standard deemed this no less than a find of the century. Scharer seemed to concur, telling the New York Times, "I'll never have an experience like that again." But when it comes to unearthing overlooked and underpriced art trophies, he keeps repeating that experience. His identifications and retrievals, he says, are the equivalent of being struck by a kind of electricity multiple times. In Cliff's case, lightning strikes a lot, explains Jim Wheelow, director emeritus of the Worcester Art Museum, WAM. It's just not a fluke in his life. It's part of his DNA. Over the past decade or so, Scharer has stumbled across 2 Van Dycks and relocated 5 Turners. He's been restoring an altarpiece fragment attributed to El Greco that, he suspects, was rescued from a burning church during the Spanish Civil War. He regularly identifies or re-identifies works by significant old masters, listed as by an unidentified artist. His specialty is the forgotten Rembrandt or Rubens that has somehow slipped between the cracks and ended up, in his words, sleeping in plain sight. His hunches don't always prove correct. He's been suckered by at least a few forgeries or phonies. Sometimes you follow threads that turn into an unraveling sweater, he admits, but many filaments he's followed have led to veritable treasures. The previously unrecorded Van Harlan he spotted in New Jersey that now hangs in the Art Institute of Chicago, a Cezanne he snagged from a Campbell Soup heiress and helped place in Ireland's National Gallery, and three possibilities he scooped up on the cheap that were subsequently reattributed to the Milanese maestro Daniel Crespi. He also owns four works from Rembrandt's studio, he claims, including two that I believe are by the master himself. Shorer, who does not hold a university degree in art history, is largely self-taught and makes many of his finds in his spare time. He also employs runners to scour auctions around the world in search of hidden gems. All day and night, he says, we send pictures back and forth by WhatsApp going, do we think this is this? The Sunday Times Magazine, UK, describes him as being well-known in the art world for his eye. Shorer formulates it slightly differently. I'm known in the art world for rediscovering lost things. Despite having left high school at age 15, Shorer, 58, is an exceptionally knowledgeable, if mercurial, and at times elusive man. He is lanky, with piercing dark eyes, short cropped hair, and a trim white beard. I'm no one with no particular education, he stated in an oral history project for the Smithsonian's Archives of American Art. I come to it with an open pair of eyeballs. The types of paintings Shorer seeks are known as sleepers. A sleeper is the name that the picture trade bestows upon a work being sold below its true value because it is mistakenly thought to be fake, specious, a probable copy, or the work of an inconsequential artist. A sleeper hunter is an individual like Shorer who stalks such errors or misattributions in listings at auctions. Whenever he acquires sleepers, he joins forces with experts to reassess and properly catalog the paintings. Then he and his team often unload them at a profit to blue-chip institutions, using the proceeds to procure more beauties. Shorer's success at rousing sleepers enabled him to put together the investment group that purchased the venerable London gallery Agnew's in 2014. He then acquired a 290-acre forest in Vermont. Recently, he became the owner of a Gatsby-style mansion on an approximately 4-acre private island in the Long Island Sound, where J.P. Morgan's great-grandson has resided. Shorer is renovating the place to sell. I first met him in New York City after a Christie's auction, where he just won a Turner for more than $1 million. His intent was for Agnew's to offer it over the coming years at a higher price to the European market. What moves him, however, isn't lucrative deals. He isn't an art dealer at all. Instead, he contends that his goals are threefold: to resurrect forsaken or neglected artworks, to repatriate pieces spoliated by the Nazis, and to die in possession of a single perfect painting, ideally an unobtainable Leonardo. This last aspiration could require selling everything else he owns, but, as he once said, I don't mind living in a cardboard box. When asked where he normally lives, he replies, a tad testily, I don't really normally live anywhere. He divides his time between Provincetown and homes in Boston, London, and Mashpee, Massachusetts. He attends art fairs, lectures, and meetings in Europe once or twice a month. A favorite pastime, he says, is going to symposia that end just short of fisticuffs between scholars and attribution. A collector and art lover, Shorer is above all a dedicated investigator. He compares the way his mind works to those wall-mounted corkboards in classic crime shows, the kind with thumbtacked photos of suspects and murder scenes and corroborating evidence, all linked together by pieces of string. Instead of a Sherlock Holmes-style magnifying glass, he uses precision binocular headband magnifiers, large benchtop microscopes, reverse image searches and online databases, and high-tech tactics, such as MAXRF spectroscopy or dendrochronology, that apply laboratory analytics to decode a painting's makeup and approximate age. As cutting-edge as his forensics may be, however, Shorer, upon receiving that envelope in April 2021, found himself getting pulled into a strangely old-fashioned cold case. Next photos, unearthed gems. Shorer located this last juror circa 1503, pictured here, as well as a stolen early 17th century Avocamp, which was reproduced on a throw pillow. The dossier consisted of whatever scant information was available about the nine paintings that had vanished in 1978, 43-year-old police reports, original bills of sale, insurance documents, invoices, and most importantly to Shorer, photocopied reproductions of the actual trove, two Pissarros, two Renoirs, a Boudin, a Turner, and some intriguing old Dutch paintings. The theft had personal implications. Several of the works had been bound for the permanent collection of WAM, where Shorer had previously served as board president, and where a number of canvases he owns are currently on view. Yet despite his ties to the museum, no one had ever given him a clear description of the artworks taken in 1978 until the file arrived. The package was mailed by Warner Fletcher, a Worcester law firm director, chairman of the $50 million Stoddard Charitable Trust, and secretary treasurer of the $59 million Fletcher Foundation, organizations that have long supported WAM. The plundered artworks had belonged to Helen Estabrook Stoddard and Robert Stoddard, Fletcher's aunt and her husband, both now deceased, who'd intended to bequeath some of them to WAM. Fletcher wasn't holding his breath for Shorer to solve the largest private art theft in the city's history. He just thought the unassuming sleuth might find a new way into the long moribund search. "Maybe in your wanderings," Fletcher suggested to him, "if ever you come across any of these, you might be helpful." Next photo, clip art. Robert and Helen Estabrook Stoddard in the Worcester, Massachusetts newspaper he had owned featured in a 2000 story on an exhibition celebrating their collection. Scoping the inventory in the envelope, Shorer gravitated to one painting in particular, a 17th century ice skate by Hendrik Avocamp. Among the towering figures of Holland's Golden Age, Avocamp, 1585 to 1634, is famous for his depictions of outdoor wintertime activities. Netherlanders skating and otherwise going about their business on frozen canals and waterways. In his densely peopled, somewhat freaky panoramas, figures enjoying what the Dutch call ice fever can be seen getting frisky in nippy haylofts, relieving themselves in sub-zero outhouses, hanging from dead season gallows. Avocamp made only 100 or so of his icy paintings. The artist, likely deaf and nonverbal, was known as the Mute of Kampen. He remains, in the view of Wim Pieves and Earl Appel III, respectively the emeritus directors of the Rijksmuseum and Washington, D.C.'s National Gallery of Art, the acknowledged master of the winter scene. Shorer had owned one of Avocamp's minor watercolors, which he'd auctioned off 10 weeks prior. But the stolen composition was a much bigger deal. Winter Sports, as it was known, appeared to be a masterpiece. A signed 1944 attestation, included in Fletcher's package, qualified it as one of the best works by this rare master. It was nearly four centuries old and in a pristine state of preservation. The Avocamp looked extremely desirable, Scherer emailed Fletcher. A winter scene of that type, he estimated, would today cost up to $10 million if you can buy one, but you can't. Per Sotheby's, the last two comparable Avercamps had sold at auction for $7.75 million and $8.6 million each. Scherer considered winter sports a sui generis rarity. He would only be able to establish a precise value after verifying its condition firsthand. He informed an astonished Fletcher, I believe I can run it to ground in around 15 more minutes during the business day. The trail it left behind, he felt, would likely lead to the remaining Worcester paintings. But first, he needed to establish what exactly had happened on the night of the theft. Worcester, the second biggest urban center in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, is a post-industrial city an hour west of Boston. As you drive into town, you are greeted by a welcome sign in the shape of an open book with blank pages, as though you're entering a story that hasn't yet been written. Sometime after midnight on June 22, 1978, according to the police report, a vehicle containing an undetermined number of nondescript thieves cruised through the upscale neighborhood of Forest Grove. They turned onto Monmouth Road. The last home on the dead-end street was a stately blue-and-white fairy tale mansion belonging to the art patrons Helen and Robert Stoddard. Their 36-acre property occupied one of the city's choicest private lots. The gabled 10-bedroom home, dominated by dark wood and soaring ceilings, was done in high-end arts and crafts style. The walls were adorned with works by Eugène Delacroix, Georgia O'Keeffe, and Marc Chagall. In the midsummer darkness, the robbers made their way toward the Stoddards' immense backyard. Ignoring the lavish gardens and the helipad, they sought a way in through the rear sun porch. Helen Stoddard, known locally as the Grande Dame of Worcester, had attended the Sorbonne, where she'd developed a lifelong love of fine art, especially French Impressionism. At her urging, the couple had started collecting tableaux. The first piece they acquired was a small Renoir landscape. Helen couldn't imagine living without it. An ardent Francophile, she'd helped establish WAM's member council and would continue volunteering on museum committees into her 90s. Next photos, master's works, a possible Rembrandt, circa 1629, that Scherer found. The FBI reclaimed the Stoddard's 1902 Pissarro in a 1998 raid. Robert Stoddard ran a lucrative metal manufacturing business and was a majority owner of the Worcester Telegram, later to become the Telegram and Gazette, which the New York Times Company eventually bought for $295 million. An amateur helicopter pilot, he enjoyed vintage automobiles and could be seen driving around town in his Bentley, sporting a pork pie hat. In 1958, he co-founded the right-wing John Birch Society, the extremist group that would help give rise to the modern conservative movement. If you tried to sit to his right at a table, he'd warn you that you might fall off the edge of the world. Retrograde politically, he was a big-spending philanthropist and a prime target for a burglary. He also happened to be a notoriously deep sleeper. On the night of the break-in, according to news reports, only Robert was home. His wife was in the hospital undergoing jaw surgery. He finished his usual pre-sleep milk and cookies and got into bed by 11:45 p.m. Not long after, the thieves tried to force their way in by prying apart a jalousie window with a screwdriver. When that didn't work, they broke the glass pane on the back breezeway door. The key to the deadbolt was sitting in the lock. Turning it, the crooks walked right in. They helped themselves to snacks in the refrigerator and booze from the liquor cabinet. Since they'd come without proper carrying cases for the artworks, they slashed open pillows from the sofa, strewing fluff all over the floor. They stuffed paintings into pillowcases, police surmised, and packed smaller ivory objet and jewel boxes into antique fire buckets. They also rifled through Stoddard's bedroom without disturbing his slumber. They placed a fire poker nearby, apparently in case he awoke and needed to be subdued, but he dozed through it all, even as the thieves ransacked the place. Upon waking at 6 a.m., Stoddard found his glasses on the floor. His wallet was missing from the bedside bureau, as were two of his watches. The couple's beloved Pissarro port scene, which had hung above their mantelpiece, was gone. So was Helen's prized Renoir, the light of her life. Another seven paintings, including the Avercamp and the Turner, were now empty spots on the wall. A trail of footprints and pillow feathers marked the getaway route through the backyard. "Bumblers pull off a perfect crime," read the headline in the Telegram. Worcester's police department called it an amateurish job done by petty thieves, but for small-timers, they'd either gotten fantastically lucky, or they'd known precisely which paintings were the most valuable. The Stoddard's collection had been appraised for insurance purposes 11 months prior. All the priciest pieces were the very ones that had been taken. It was as if, officers noted, the thieves had been given a list of paintings to steal. Even so, the ensuing investigation went nowhere. The sergeant assigned to the case would later acknowledge that the authorities had never even come up with a suspect. Insinuations that Robert Stoddard had orchestrated it for the insurance payout were summarily dismissed. His wealth was such that the amount he stood to receive from Liberty Mutual, on whose board of directors he served, was described as a drop in the bucket. Perhaps the most interesting detail was that pillowcases played a part in the caper, because a pillowcase was precisely what would end up leading Scharrer to the Avercamp. The manila envelope beside him, Scharrer picked up his MacBook Pro and started searching Hendrik Avercamp images online on the off chance he might find a digital footprint of the Stoddard's winterscape. At first, nothing relevant popped up, but as he scanned the Google search results, he had a thought. If I knew I had a hot painting previously attributed to Avercamp, to whom would I attribute it if I wanted to push it through the market and get away with it? In other words, what would a fence do? The move to any art detective was obvious. Try to sell it as something close to but not exactly the real thing. Scharrer retried the image search using the name of the painter's best-known disciple, his nephew Berend Avercamp. Within a few moments, a thumbnail appeared that matched the photocopied reproduction in his file. "Bingo!" he exclaimed, zooming in. As he'd suspected, the painting had been falsely ascribed to an Avercamp follower. Berend's works were inferior to his uncle's, and were substantially less, but also easier to peddle without drawing attention. Scharrer clicked on the thumbnail, which brought him to a website called pixels.com. "That's insane," he muttered to himself, eyeing the screen. Reproductions of the pilfered Avercamp were being sold as decorative throw pillows. For $18.40, anyone could buy a pillowcase with the Stoddard's long-lost ice scape printed on it. The machine-washable coverlets weren't the only products that featured the painting. The company's print-on-demand technology meant you could get the Avercamp on a yoga mat, a coffee mug, a bath towel, or an iPhone case. The original was last seen in 1978, before digital photography existed. So how, Scharrer wondered, had Pixels.com gotten access to an image that could be reproduced on products? There was only one answer. Someone must have scanned it recently. Scharrer looked closer at the on-screen pillowcase. The underlying rendering, he noticed, belonged to a collection called Bridgman Images, a digital fine art archive. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selection by Mark Kaufman. Today's broadcast is in honor of my mother, who taught me that reading is the ultimate joy